I am Plata on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Beginning tomorrow night at the Gateway Theatre is their latest production, Gross Misconduct, written by the playwright Megan Gardner, who joins me now. The play comes at a timely moment in the world in the era of Me Too and Time's Up. Ms. Gardner's play about two men who find themselves sharing a cell at Millhaven Prison, contending with choices in the past, violence, as well as revenge and rehabilitation. It's difficult not to give away the play, so I'll ask Megan about this work, and she can tell us as much as she'd like about the themes they're in, the time we're in, and what men ought to consider during this critical time in society. Megan Gardner is a playwright and performer. Her writing credits include Blind Spot, Roll Call, We Three, Love Bomb, Blondie, and Dissolve, her one-woman show that for 12 years she took around the world. She has been nominated for Leo Awards for screenwriting among countless awards like the Sidney J. Risk Award. Gross Misconduct runs until the 23rd of March. The production is directed by Kayvon Koshkam, and the cast features Scott Bellis, Ian Butcher, Mike Gill, and Sariana Milani. Visit gatewaytheatre.com for tickets and information. Please welcome to the Plant Online program Megan Gardner. Ms. Gardner, good morning.
Good morning, Joe. Nice to hear from you.
Nice to talk to you. It's great to have the playwright on, because then you can tell us as much as you'd like about Gross Misconduct without having to spoil it. So I mean, what is the show about?
Well, the show, I would say that it encapsulates a lot of different themes. I initially wanted to write about punishment versus rehabilitation, mm-hmm. so I naturally set it in a prison. But I also wanted to have men engage other men on the ramifications, the repercussions, the consequences of violence against women. So it seemed to be a natural place to set the play was in a prison, but I didn't realize that the themes of punishment versus rehabilitation would also then trickle into what I wanted to say regarding having men finally speak out against violence against women and have them take ownership over an issue that, I hate to say it, but is ultimately theirs. I do believe yeah. that violence against women is a men's issue. It happens primarily to women, but men are overwhelmingly the perpetrators. So I wanted to see something on stage that reflected that.
But don't you think it says something about our culture that men haven't taken ownership over that? I mean, and so what is the remedy afford? I suppose a piece of art like Gross Misconduct would be a way to start that conversation, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I will tell you and your listeners that I have a one-woman show that I've been touring for, and I had been touring for about 13 years.
Right.
And it's based on my own experience of sexual violence. And after the show became a very big success, and I was asked to be on the board of a great organization in our province called the Ending Violence Association of BC. And they were putting a campaign together called Be More Than a Bystander. Uh-huh. And what it was it was encouraging people to step in when they saw incidents of violence or abuse, assault, harassment. And what they did is they got on board the BC Lions football team.
Uh-huh.
And those players went into high schools and spoke to the students about violence against women. And so I was on the board and helped with develop some of the content. And then I went to see one of the presentations, and I was just floored at how you could hear a pin drop.
Mm.
And I had been performing at that point in schools for 12 to 13 years. So
yeah.
I knew that I was able to get their attention in one way, but these men were able to get their attention in a different way. And that was the catalyst for me of knowing that my next piece, I wanted it to be men speaking to other men. Not discounting all of the amazing work that women have done on the issue, but I just felt that it was time to see men tackle it and to see men take ownership over it, or at least realize their role.
Right, right. So the Gross Misconduct takes place in a prison. I guess it's Millhaven. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And so when we see is that how you pronounce his name? Deke.
Deke. Yeah.
So he's been in prison how long?
Well, I don't want to give that away.
Okay. All right.
he gets a new cellmate.
Right.
So he's been there for
a while.
He's been there for a while.
Right.
Yeah. And he gets a new cellmate, and they are immediately at odds with one another because of their age difference and just differences in growing up, privilege versus less than so they don't get along.
Yeah, and so, what can you tell us about the new cellmate? You mentioned that they're of different ages, so he's younger than Deke, right?
Yes, he's in his early 20s. Deke is in his late 40s, and Corey comes in, and his privilege is showing. He's just he's in there. He doesn't think he should be in there. His dad is working on an appeal. He thinks he's going to get out, and he's still proclaiming his innocence. And that doesn't come out. And initially, it's just the dynamics of a 6x8 prison cell.
Yeah.
And what two people who are put in there for crimes. So they're not, you know, they're not the greatest people.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when you put two people into a 6x8 cell? What are we expecting? What are we expecting to happen? Are we really expecting them to be rehabilitated when there's no rehabilitation actually in the prison itself?
Yeah.
What are we hoping is going to happen here? Are we truly thinking that they are going to be better people when they come out? I'm not sure. I don't have the answer. I'm just curious about exploring that. Is when you treat people like animals, how do you expect them to behave anything but animals?
Right.
Behave like anything but animals. So the two of them with very different personalities are thrust into that together, and so we see what's at play. And eventually, the one thing that binds them together is hockey. And the term gross misconduct is the name of a penalty that isn't used anymore in the NHL, but it used to be, and it was sort of the worst of the worst penalty. So it's the one thing that eventually, through kind of a coincidence, they end up speaking about NHL, and they realize that they're both super fans of hockey. So it bonds them, even though their experiences, their crimes, their background, their ages are completely at odds with one another. But the one thing that does unite them is hockey.
So this is the world premiere. So you have been able to work with the director Kevan Koshkin throughout this production, and as well as the actors. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. This is the first. This is the first production. As you said, we've had a lot of workshops over the last, I guess, 5 years with different casts. And I like that because it has brought me different tones, takes on the characters. I've seen a lot of different interpretations, and it's really helped. A lot of different voices have contributed to this piece. About a year and a half ago, I approached Kevan because his company, while there are lots of great women involved on the board and as associates, the company is primarily run by men, and specifically young, straight, white men. And I thought, well, this is kind of my target audience. This is who I want to see own up to this issue. So wouldn't it be great if they're the ones that produce the play?
Yeah.
And actually put their time and effort and blood, sweat, and tears into producing a play that has this message that encourages us to have conversations, that for men to have conversations with other men.
So what's the dynamic been like in terms of these conversations that you've been having in terms of the work that you all have been doing, and especially for you, with these men?
Yes. Well, I would say for rehearsals, I have not been there that much because I do think it's important that they work with what they have as if it's a locked script, and then I get sort of an email, a phone call if something's not working, and then I'll come in and I'll work with them. So I haven't been there a lot by choice. I have felt that it was better for me to step back a bit because we'd done so much work in the room. I think right now what's an interesting question, and it's a question in the play, is in terms of the gray area of sexual assault, and I think we all now finally know how gray it is.
Mm-hmm.
People are really coming forward and saying, listen, what I'm wearing does not mean that I should be, that I'm asking for it, or because I drank this much, it doesn't mean that I was asking for it. It still ends up being quite gray, and survivors wake up blaming themselves. So the gray area is something that we've really explored. But I do believe there's also a need for understanding what consent is for young men. And I first started writing this play when I was pregnant with my son. And it was the first time that I realized, wow, if my son was assaulted, I would want one outcome. I would want that perpetrator to be punished. But if my son was accused of assaulting someone, I would want rehabilitation.
Mm.
And those are at odds with one another, obviously. So it was just an interesting question I have. Again, I don't have the answers, but I'm posing a question within the play of, Does everybody deserve to be held accountable? Absolutely. Does everybody deserve to be ruined? I don't know. I don't think so. I'm not sure. I really, truly don't know, because one person can say, I didn't know that was assault. I didn't think I was assaulting her. I thought she was into it. And then you have somebody else who spent 5 years recovering from what they have felt and truly and honestly believed in their heart was rape. So, of course, the accountability needs to be there. Is there room for a redemption narrative? That's my question. Now that the onus is finally being placed on the people responsible for committing a sexual assault, and the only person responsible for a sexual assault is the person who commits it, now that society is finally grasping that, and I've seen it throughout my almost 15 years writing on this issue, I've really seen a shift, and I'm grateful for it. Now I feel like the conversation needs to be, what happens next? What do we do with these young men who are either admitting that they assaulted somebody or have been called out, which is happening so often, the called out culture? Uh-huh. Then what? Then uh-huh. what? Do we just discard them, or do we give them a chance at redemption? There's an amazing TED Talk of a perpetrator and his survivor, and they do the TED Talk together.
Yeah.
And they speak of the power of forgiveness. Now, I would never presume to tell a survivor how they need to recover and how they need to heal. I'm just proposing this as an option in a day and age where call-out culture is quite prominent. It's quite prevalent. People are taking to social media and calling out abusers. And I'm not saying that that's wrong. I'm just saying, is there room for rehabilitation?
Yeah. Well, you mentioned you've been writing and performing for about 15 years now.
Yeah.
What do you think you can say in art, in on stage, in plays, about these important issues that one probably couldn't anywhere else?
Well, I think what's interesting about issue-based work, and I'm really realizing this, is that you can pose questions without giving answers. That's what I love about theater it's about a dilemma. Great theater is about a dilemma where you're watching something. It's not a prescribed outcome because that's boring. It's truly a dilemma where the audience is sitting there going, huh, I don't know. And what I want is I want people to go to the bar and I want them after and I want them to disagree. Mm. I want them to believe two different outcomes that should happen in the play. I don't want to give an answer. I want dialogue, because through dialogue, then we start to understand, and through understanding, we start to change our behavior. We start to change our actions. We start to perhaps have a little bit more empathy for the other side. And I think theater does that really well. And I'm, funnily enough, I feel, my husband talks about it all the time, I do have this kind of shy bone. I'm not super confident engaging someone else in an argument or an attack or a debate, but I'll write it and then I'll let it speak for itself and then I'll run away. But I love presenting it on the stage and seeing what happens when I present a very right versus right, as opposed to right versus wrong. It's interesting to see two characters that vehemently disagree, but they both think they're right. That, to me, is exciting theater. So that's what I've done here. And it is a little bit scary. I'm a little bit nervous about the content, but I feel all it's going to do is lead to more dialogue and more conversations. And that's exactly what we need. And to be frank, we need it between men.
Right, exactly. Now, through your work, though, have you been able to say, whether it's the dialogue you've created and the dialogue that happens afterwards amongst audience members, has your own thinking changed over the last decade and a half, say, about these issues that you write about?
Oh, yes, absolutely. When I first started in 2003, I premiered Dissolve, which is my one-woman show. Mm-hmm. And Dissolve is just based on my own experience. It's my reactions and feelings and thoughts around what happened to me, which was a drugging and an assault. I didn't expect to be doing Q&As after, because I didn't think the show was going to do more than a Fringe Festival run. But I ended up doing close to 900 shows across North America spanning a decade. So everything changed, because all of a sudden I was not only doing the show, but then I was put on a panel. And I was put on a panel with experts, police officers, counselors, sexual assault nurse examiners. And through listening to them on the panel, then I learned more about the issue, and I continued to learn more about the issue. And a few of the things that struck me was, first of all, that alcohol is truly the number one, and I'm using quotations, but of course you can't see them, date rape drug. It's a term I don't, it's a term I don't really like. It implies consent, but I think people are familiar with the term date rape drug. And really, alcohol is right up there. If you are under the influence of alcohol, you're legally unable to give consent, and that's as good as a no. And when I was touring the show, starting around 12, 15 years ago, people didn't really know that yet. So that was a discovery that I made. And then I included it in my talk back so that the next time I was giving a talk back, I could say that. And so I just kept gathering these little pieces of these nuggets, these gold nuggets that weren't being shared as widely as they should have been. And all of those nuggets, I think, have contributed to gross misconduct, especially realizing that, wow, violence against women, that's a men's issue. And one of my heroes, Tracy Porteous, who's the executive director of the Ending Violence Association, she said, and I will sort of paraphrase the quote, but until the majority of men who do not commit violence against women speak out against the minority of men who do, we are only going to get so far in our efforts. It's not, I'm not saying all men are bad. I'm married to a wonderful man and I have a son, but we need to come together and we need to speak out against those of us who are giving the gender a bad name.
We
need to see the ramifications of what this is doing to the female gender, and men need to take ownership.
Now, so you're an artist, you're a playwright.
Yeah.
Do you view your work other than art itself as a service, especially for the audiences that'll eventually be talking about this work later on?
Yes, I do now. I because of my experience with Dissolve and going to schools, I did a lot of Frosch Weeks. So I would be brought in just to do the show for every single Frosch, every single first year or freshman in the States. And there were some schools where it was mandatory. They had to scan their student card and they would pay a fine if they didn't see Dissolve. Like, it was part of the curriculum. So I started to, yes, understand that, wow, this is more than art. And usually the Q&A would take longer than the actual show, because the minute that I started to open up about my own experience, inevitably I would speak to at least three, if not 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 other survivors after every single show. So I've spoken to thousands. I've probably been the first person, at least a couple hundred have ever told, and I take that responsibility very seriously. I burnt out because I wasn't prepared for it, but I took it very seriously, and I do feel it's a great question, because I do feel like that's what I want. That's what I feel that art should do. It can do, and it should do, and it's the kind of art that I want to make.
How did you deal with the burnout after hearing people's stories after each performance at these talkbacks?
Yeah. In the moment, probably not very well. I mean, I was inspired by them, and the courage that these survivors would take in telling me is what inspired me to get back in my car and drive to the next school.
Yeah.
But I did take a lot of breaks. I'm also a freelance actor, so I would just take other contracts. I work a lot in musical theater, so there was nothing like ending a Dissolve tour and then starting, you know, Beauty and the Beast, where I'm playing an inanimate object for 8 weeks and singing and dancing. And I would have to take those breaks. They were crucial to my mental health. And eventually I just got to a point where I just knew I was done. And frankly, I was getting too old to play the part. So, funnily enough, I actually went to see a new actress just yesterday, who has taken over the role and the show. And I was very moved to watch her perform Dissolve, because I realized, wow, this play is almost 18 years old from when I started writing it, and it's completely relevant. Not that much has changed. We're just now talking about it.
Yeah. It's unfortunate that not much has changed, but you've contributed a great deal, I think, especially with your audiences in terms of, you know, I was going to say, as I was reading your bio, you're one of these people, I guess you have to be in this town out of necessity to have these hyphenates in your job descriptions.
Yes.
I mean, it has worked out for you in terms of being able to move from project to project for your own health, right?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It has worked out, and I wouldn't want it any other way, because I feel like I have contributed to society. A lot of performers, I think, sometimes wonder, what am I doing? What am I saying? Where's my voice in all of this? And I certainly have, I have screamed from the mountaintops, and it feels good. It feels good to do that. Also because of the support that I've received and people's encouragement to keep going. And that has, I often thought I'm going to have victims stamped on my forehead if I tell my story. And really, I have survivor on there. And that has garnered me respect that I wasn't expecting. I was expecting pity. And I don't do well with that. And it's turned the other way. So I'm quite grateful.
Well, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. And like a lot of people listening, I'm looking forward to Gross Misconduct. Congratulations on all your work and break a leg, as they say.
Thank you. It's been great chatting with you, too.
Gross Misconduct runs at the Gateway Theater the 14th to the 23rd of March. Visit gatewaytheater.com for tickets. Megan Gardner joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.